Hi, I'm David Fettes, and this talk is about politics. And politics is a major part of what is studied by sociology. Politics is the process by which groups of people make social and economic decisions. The term is generally applied to civil governments, but politics has been observed in all human group interactions, including corporate, academic, and religious institutions. That's surely the case. If you've ever worked in a university, you know that there is college politics. If you've worked in a church, you know there's church politics. And anybody who's ever worked for any corporation knows that you better know the politics and the structure of the place. So politics is involved in a lot of different things, and it's not always a bad thing, but it is a real thing. Politics consists of social relations involving authority or power, the regulation of political units, and the methods and tactics used to formulate and to apply social policy. Political power is a type of power held by a group in a society which allows that group to administrate the distribution of public resources, including labor and wealth. Political powers are not limited to heads of state. Some people have great political clout, even if they've never been elected or even if they're not a king. There are some people who have informal power, but it is very great power. However, the extent to which a person or group such as an insurgency, a terrorist group, or a multinational corporation possesses such power relates to the amount of societal influence they can wield, formally or informally. So whether it's a terrorist or the head of a corporation or somebody who is trying to start a revolution, they have power only if they can wield influence. Power, then, is often defined as the ability to influence the behavior of others with or without resistance. Sometimes they resist your influence, sometimes you're able to influence them, and they either don't notice your influence or they like your influence. In government, authority is often used interchangeably with the term power. However, the meanings differ. Authority refers to a claim of legitimacy, the justification and right to exercise power. For example, while a mob has the power to punish a criminal, for example, by lynching, people who believe in the rule of law consider that only a court of law has the authority to order capital punishment. So you might say, well, a mob has the power to kill somebody, but only the government has the authority to execute somebody. So there's a difference of understanding between what is legitimate authority and just raw power. Max Weber, a German sociologist, at least of German background, identified and distinguished three types of legitimate authority: rational legal authority, traditional authority, and charismatic authority. Let's look at a little more about each of those. Rational legal authority is a form of authority that bases its legitimacy on formal rules and established laws of the state, which are usually written down in a document like a constitution or articles of incorporation. Modern societies depend on legal rational authority. Government officials like the U.S. president are examples of this form of authority. They have constitutional powers, but they don't just get to do whatever they want, or at least they're not supposed to. Traditional authority derives from long-established customs, habits, and social structures. This is the way it's been. We inherited power. This is just kind of the way the society has kind of gone along without anybody examining it, and so this is how we keep doing it. When power passes from one generation to another, then it's known as traditional authority. The right of hereditary monarchs to rule, like the King of Saudi Arabia, is an example. So monarchs who are on the throne because their parent was before them, that's hereditary authority, and that's one form of traditional authority. Or you might have a tribal group in which the elders have always had the say, and you kind of had new elders from time to time, but nobody has a constitution which says what they have to do or what they may not do. There's just kind of a shared understanding that these are to be the elders, and this is kind of how they're supposed to run things. And then there's charismatic authority. Here, the charisma or gift of the individual or leader plays an important role. Charismatic authority is that authority which is derived from a gift of grace, the power of one's personality, or when the leader claims that his authority is derived from a higher power, like God, that is superior to both the validity of traditional and rational legal authority. Followers accept this and are willing to follow this higher or inspired authority in the place of the authority that they've hitherto been following. Clear examples of charismatic leaders are often seen in the founders of religious groups, such as Joseph Smith Jr., the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. He broke from existing church authority, and he had a certain personality that captivated some people, and so he was able to exercise authority. Someone such as Jesus Christ would probably be identified as somebody who had charismatic authority. He was not educated in the recognized schools of the time. He wasn't part of the in-group of the main leaders or the priests, but he just had a personality and a power and a charisma, and of course, it wasn't just a claim. He really was from God and was God himself, but he's the supreme example, of course, of charismatic authority, of someone whose sheer personality and ability was so obvious that his leadership was recognized. And there's other people like that too, where maybe they don't have all the advantages and they wouldn't have come to power by being children of a monarch or by having the Constitution designate them, but simply their leadership and their personality and their force of personality wins people over to them. So you have those kinds of authority. The kind of authority that's written down on paper and spelled out in laws, rational legal authority. The kind of authority that's just kind of, well, that's the way it's been. These are the people who've been running the show. And so we'll keep doing it that way. And we're not going to write it down or spell it out, but that's just how it is. And then you get charismatic authority, where just the personal force of personality wins people over. Sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. There have been heads of suicide cults who had charismatic authority, as well as some wonderful people with tremendous charismatic authority. In most modern nation states, the government has authority maintained by its use of political violence, which gives it power. The fact that government has authority gives it the right to use power to force citizens to do what the government deems appropriate. This may make people fidget a little bit, but it's just a fact that much government authority is ultimately rooted in its power to punish. In other words, the government has the right, based on its authority, to force people to behave in certain ways. Refusal to follow the dictates of the government can result in the government using violence to coerce individuals into compliance. The government might kill you if you don't go along with it in some settings. It might imprison you. It might jail you. It might just fine you a bunch of money. But government provides consequences if you don't do what it wants. And so it's not just violence can extend to more than just physical violence, killing. It can also be imprisoning or fining or forcing consequences on somebody that they would not choose for themselves. At the same time, the fact that a country's government has the right to use violence, which is theoretically a near exclusive right, others can use violence only when officially sanctioned, such as a hunting license, or if one belongs to a government-sanctioned fighting league. Let's say you're part of a boxing federation, you get to punch people, but you don't get to punch people just out on the street, or the government will imprison you for assault. So the government has the right to violence, and the only other people who get to use it are those whom the government licenses, and that reinforces the government's claim to authority. Thus, you have something of a paradox. Do governments have authority if they don't have the right to use violence? And do governments derive their authority from their right to use violence? Ask yourself, would you follow the law if there were no repercussions to your behavior? Would you pay taxes if you would not be punished for not paying taxes? Would you steal something? Would you keep the zoning laws? Would you keep the speed laws if you weren't afraid of the police? While you might follow the law for other reasons, like you might not drive 140, not just because it's against the law, but because it's a quick way to get yourself killed. You may obey the laws for other reasons, but ultimately it is the threat of legitimate use of violence that makes government authority compelling. The Bible has something to say about this. It says, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authority is God's servant, an agent of wrath, to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authority, not only because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience. God knows that everybody in a society is sinful, and the rulers are too, but God has established it so that there's a threat for doing things that are harmful to society and that are just downright bad. And so there is the fear of punishment, which should restrain people. But for Christians, there's also the fear of the Lord, the fact that God has set up authority, and so we should honor authority except when it's using its power contrary to ways that God has appointed and contrary to things that are good for society. Because this passage in Romans 13 also says that God has established them as God's servants for your good, to do you good. And that we'll get into that a little bit more in this talk further on, where the role of government is to serve God and to serve people. That's something the sociologists can't talk to, but government is a public servant in two senses, a servant of God, a servant of the society in which they've been given responsibility to rule. What are types of government? Well, here are some of them. Along with various legitimate means of holding power, there are various forms of government. One's monarchy, another is democracy, another totalitarianism, oligarchy, communism, and theocracy. We'll look at each of those briefly. In monarchy, supreme power is absolutely or nominally lodged with an individual. Sometimes it's nominally because somebody who is the king is not the main ruler anymore. Sometimes the prime minister and the parliament have more actual political power than the king. But absolutely or nominally lodged in an individual who is the head of state, often for life or until abdication, until they leave. The person who heads a monarchy is called a monarch. It was a common form of government in the world during the ancient and medieval times. There is no clear definition of monarchy. Often they're called a king or a queen or an emperor. But monarchs have this power, and it's usually a hereditary power, until they die. And unfortunately, sometimes the only way to change government then would be to kill the monarch and make yourself the monarch. Holding unlimited political power in the state is not the defining characteristic, as many constitutional monarchies, such as the United Kingdom and Thailand, are considered monarchies, yet their monarchs have limited political power. Ever since the days of the Magna Carta in England, for instance, the nobles had it down in writing, certain things that kings couldn't do and other things that kings had to do. So being a monarch doesn't necessarily make you a dictator who gets to do whatever he wants. It just means that you've inherited the position, that you hold it for life, and that they don't vote you in or vote you out. But you still may be a monarch under the rule of the law. Hereditary rule is a common characteristic, but elective monarchies are also considered monarchies. For instance, the Pope. He gets elected by the College of Cardinals, but the system of government under which a Pope operates is that he's a monarch. He gets to give the orders, and the bishops and the cardinals get to take the orders. So just in terms of the structure of it, he can be elected, but once elected, he does hold that power. And some countries have hereditary rulers but are considered republics, like the Dutch Republic. Currently, there are 44 nations that have monarchs as heads of state, including 16 that recognize the monarch of the United Kingdom as their head of state. And in cases like that, the queen may be the nominal head of state, but really those countries are no longer run by the British government or run by the British queen, but they are run by their own government. So that the United Kingdom and its monarchy used to have the king ruling the empire, but it's not so much that way anymore. Democracy is a form of government in which the right to govern or sovereignty is held by the majority of citizens within a country or a state. In political theory, democracy describes a small number of related forms of government and also a political philosophy. Even though there's no universally accepted definition of democracy, there are two principles that any definition of democracy includes. The first principle is that all members of the society, the citizens, have equal access to power, and second, that all members, citizens, enjoy universally recognized freedoms and liberties. Even that one might be a little bit of a stretch, because the Greeks are understood kind of as the earliest form of democracy, but there they had many slaves who had no vote. They weren't citizens, and maybe they weren't considered members of the society, but they were certainly part of the people living there, but they had no access to power. So even democracy can be limited to a certain number of people within a society who get to vote, and it may be a large number of people, but others are non-citizens, and they don't get to vote. There are several varieties of democracy. Some provide better representation and more freedoms for their citizens than others. However, if any democracy is not carefully legislated to avoid an uneven distribution of political power with balances, such as the separation of powers, then a branch of the system of rule could accumulate power and become harmful to the democracy itself. For instance, there are different branches of government in the United States: the presidency, the Congress, the Supreme Court, and the other courts. And if the Supreme Court gets too much power, then it overrules anything that the president does or that the Congress does that the Supreme Court happens not to like. Or if the president gets too much power, then the Congress just votes in whatever the president is pushing for, and the Supreme Court approves it, and you get too much power in one part of the... And anytime you get a great, great concentration of power, it endangers overall freedom and democracy. Majority rule is often described as a characteristic feature of democracy, but without responsible government, it's possible for the rights of a minority to be abused by the tyranny of the majority. Essential for representative democracies are competitive elections that are fair both substantively and procedurally. So you can have tyranny of the majority. And that means, hey, it's a democracy in the sense that the majority rules, but if you're not part of the 51% and the minority has no rights, it's not much fun living in a democracy like that. And so it's great to have a Bill of Rights and a rule of law within a democracy where you may get to pick your rulers, but those rulers are still limited by having to treat everybody with fairness. And so you can't just pick on religious minorities or other kinds of minorities if you happen to be part of the majority. But some countries don't have that kind of limit. And so they may elect a majority of a certain religion, and then they oppress people of minority religions. So you can have oppression in democracy. Representative democracies have to have elections that work. And that means that the procedures have to be fair and honest. But also, if whoever has a gazillion dollars is able to buy all the airtime and a better candidate can't buy airtime, then sometimes you wind up with some pretty poor candidates who just happen to have an awful lot of money. So those are some of the dangers that can come along in democracy and rule of the majority. Freedom of political expression, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, those are essential so that citizens are informed and are able to vote in their personal interests in a democracy. If somebody has a democracy but allows no freedom of the press, he says, I'm president, and any newspaper that publishes anything against me will be shot or put out of business, and any TV station and every other form of media must never say anything negative about me or they will be jailed. Well, you can say that's a democracy because people still go to the polls, they still vote, and of course they vote for the only guy that they ever hear anything good about because there is no freedom of expression. Totalitarianism is a political system that strives to regulate nearly every aspect of public and private life. Totalitarian regimes or movements maintain themselves in political power by means of an official, all-embracing ideology and propaganda disseminated through the state-controlled mass media, a single party that controls the state, personality cults, control over the economy, regulation and restriction of free discussion and criticism, the use of mass surveillance, spying on everybody, and widespread use of state terrorism. Doesn't sound like much fun. But that's the kind of system that a lot of people in our world, unfortunately, have lived under. And there are degrees also of totalitarianism. Some people think that if a vote occurred, it's not totalitarian. But totalitarian just means absolute rule. It's not a comment on how they get there. Hitler once won an election. But then he used all these things to have absolute and total power. We also need to realize that if you freely elect people in one country, you still may have less freedom than another country with a monarch if the elected people are trying to do too much and the monarch is very limited in what he's trying to do. For instance, in old times, a king might reign and he would have a 10% tax, and for the most part, he stayed out of people's business. In the modern state, you might get to elect all of those officials, but they might tax 50 or 60% of your income and have books and books and books and books of laws and regulations. And so you can actually have a democracy, a democratically elected government, which comes a bit closer to totalitarianism than an old-fashioned monarchy that mostly stayed out of your business and took 10% of your money. So again, politics can be very interesting, and the words we use, we sometimes think of a totalitarianism as associated with monarchy and not democracy, but it's not necessarily that way. Oligarchy is when a few people rule. In oligarchy, power effectively rests with a small elite segment of society distinguished by royalty, wealth, family, military, or religious hegemony. Such states are often controlled by politically powerful families whose children are heavily conditioned and mentored to be heirs of the power of the oligarchy. And oligarchy isn't always official. In fact, often it's not. But for the United States, let me just mention three names. Kennedy, Clinton, Bush. These were not monarchs, but they had immense power and amassed immense wealth and managed to get elected to the presidency and to many other important positions. If you were to look at the Supreme Court of the United States, nearly all of those justices came through Harvard or Yale University. If you didn't go through Harvard or Yale, good luck getting on the Supreme Court. So you could have an oligarchy where actually a very small segment of society has control of who has access to the levers of power. And again, the United States has opportunity for many others. I'm not saying that it's purely an oligarchy, but I am saying that many, many democracies have families of immense wealth and influence where it's really close to oligarchy, even though you get to vote. A communist state has single-party rule of a communist party, and a professed allegiance to an ideology of communism as the guiding principle of the state. We'll say more about communism when we talk about economy in this course, but for now, we're looking at the political dimension of communism. Communist states may have several legal political parties, but the Communist Party is usually granted a special or dominant role in government, often by statute or under the Constitution. They'll let other parties exist as long as they never come to power. Isn't that sweet? Consequently, the institutions of the state and of the Communist Party become intimately entwined, such as the development of parallel institutions. In most communist states, governments assert that they represent the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat. That's a big fancy phrase for "we are the will of the people." The Communist Party is the workers' party. We do only what the people want anyway. In practice, it usually means that a small clique of power-hungry dictators run the show, but they claim to represent the will and to seek the well-being of all the people. In practice, it's pretty hard to find a communist state that was not bullying and brutal and close to totalitarian. While almost all claim lineage to Marxist thought, there are many varieties of communist states with indigenous adaptations. For Marxist-Leninists, the state and the Communist Party claim to act in accordance with the wishes of the industrial working class. For Maoists in China, the state and party claim to act on behalf of the peasantry. So, as I said, they claim to represent the poor people, the working people. And if you read about Chairman Mao himself, he lived in absolute opulent luxury. If you read about the rulers of the Soviet Union, of Russia, and the states under their power, the Marxist-Leninists, they lived in fabulous wealth, but they were the glorious champions of the poor because the government is always right and the government represents the people. But that's how the communist state operated. Theocracy is a form of government in which a god or deity is recognized as the state's supreme civil ruler, or in a broader sense, a form of government in which a state is governed by immediate divine guidance or by officials who are regarded as divinely guided. Theocratic governments enact theonomic laws. Theocracy should be distinguished from other secular forms of government that have a state religion or are merely influenced by theological or moral concepts, and monarchies held by the grace of God, where they consider the monarch to have God's blessing. Theocratic tendencies have been found in several religious traditions. We'll look at those in a moment, but just want to point out that just because a nation has "In God We Trust" on its currency or says its pledge of allegiance that we're under God doesn't make it a theocracy. It may recognize the supremacy of God without saying we have a direct pipeline to God. All our laws come directly from God and God is pleased with everything we do. A theocracy has that kind of structure where the rulers claim to be speaking directly for God in all circumstances and are never wrong. Along with various legitimate means of holding power, these are the various forms of government: monarchy, democracy, totalitarianism, oligarchy, communism, theocracy. Now, we've looked at some of the types of government and a little bit of the background. What does history teach us of these different types of government? Well, Winston Churchill said, "Many forms of government have been tried and will be tried in this world of sin and woe. No one pretends that democracy is perfect or all-wise. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time." So there are a lot of problems with democracy, a lot of problems where people get to vote for their leaders and have a lot of input into how a society is run. A lot of things go wrong in a democracy. It's the absolute worst form of government you can find, except for all the others that we've tried. So, and part of the reason for that is that democracy splits up power and doesn't commit too much power to any one fallen sinner. Now, when we think about what history teaches us, it's appropriate to ask about Christianity and politics. You didn't really think I was just going to leave politics to the textbook and to the non-Christian writers of it, did you? Let's think a little bit about Christianity and its role in politics. And in particular, some principles that have been very important in shaping societies in a way that is better. Because if you just look at it historically, most of the societies that have the most freedoms and opportunities are societies that have had the longest Christian background and influence. And I want to highlight six things. Government under God. Government is not God. Then the rule of law, and not just the rule of persons. The separation of powers. The value of each individual person. Authority used in service, and the vision of government. Not a vision just of building pyramids or grand structures and monuments to myself, and not using slaves and everybody else to get my projects done, or using soldiers to invade and conquer as much territory as I can. But the vision of Christianity and politics is it helps people and gives them freedom to flourish in their own lives rather than just amassing glory and wealth for the ruler. So let's look at those in a little more detail. Government is under God. This was taught in numerous ways throughout the Old Testament. Whenever a ruler would command allegiance and say, "You must pray to me and not to your God," God's people would keep right on praying. The story of Daniel in the lion's den went that way. The story of the three young men thrown into the fiery furnace went that way. They would not worship the king, and they would not worship the idol he set up. And so God had to rescue them from that furnace. But the point is, they would worship only their God. Christian mission must continue, even if rulers order it to stop. In the book of Acts, the apostles said we must obey God rather than men when they were ordered to stop preaching about Jesus. Sorry, if you order me to stop preaching about Jesus, I'm going to preach anyway because I'm a preacher. And God called me to preach, and I have to obey God before I obey anybody else. And throughout history, many people have paid a high price for speaking God's gospel when government opposed them. And even though Christians teach that we should honor government, we will not obey it when it gives commands contrary to the word of God. Rulers can be rebuked by God's word. When King David murdered one of his men and stole his wife, the prophet Nathan came and told him, "You are the man. You are guilty of murder and adultery." John the Baptist told King Herod that he could not take his brother's wife, and John was killed because of that. But rulers can be rebuked by God's word. There is no ruler who is above God and not subject to his word. Romans 13 says rulers are not gods, they are God's servants to do his purposes, and this is true even if they don't recognize God or worship him. God still got them in place for his purposes, whether they want to be or not, and he will accomplish his purposes. And they are there to serve people, not just themselves. The Bible commands us to pray for rulers, but not to pray to them. And throughout history, you had people like Julius Caesar, Alexander the Great, Nero, Antiochus Epiphanes, the list goes on and on of rulers who claimed to be divine and demanded worship. And they were all dictators. If you look at modern dictatorships, even the atheist ones, look at some of the communist countries. They say they don't believe in God. And then they have pictures of their ruler that are huge, that cover entire buildings. And they effectively treat those rulers as God. Christianity is a foundation of freedom by saying government is under God, it's not God. And Christianity lays the foundations for sound government by teaching the rule of law. Already when Moses was speaking of the future, he says eventually there's going to be a king. And when there's a king and he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law. He's to read it all the days of his life so that he may learn to revere the Lord as God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees and not consider himself better than his brothers and turn from the law to the right or to the left. So the rule of law, not of men, is one of the foundations of freedom and flourishing. A guy who gets to do whatever he wants and give whatever order he wants, those are ruin for a nation. Somebody who has it spelled out what he's allowed to do and what not to do, where there's limits on his authority, and especially, of course, if those laws are based on the word of God himself, then you're going to have better rule. You also have separation of powers as a foundation of good government. In Israel, the temple and the state government were run by different people. You had a priesthood, and you had the kingship or the judges. And later on, some political theorists would look to the Bible and say, yeah, we should have divided government. And when those who founded the American experiment in government read the Bible, they came across Isaiah 33, verse 22, where it said, "The Lord is our judge. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. It is he who will save us." And they said to themselves, yes, judge. God is the supreme judge. God is the supreme lawgiver. God is king, but among sinners, we don't want our judge and our lawgiver and our king to be the same person because only God can hold that much authority and use it wisely. We need judicial and legislative and executive power to be kept separate. No person and no branch of government can be trusted with all power because we're sinners. So yes, God can be lawgiver, God can be king, executive, God can be judge, but we're going to keep those powers separate. And that helps a country to retain its freedoms. Another aspect of Christianity which is so important in politics is the value of each person. Throughout history, a lot of people have counted for nothing. Slaves have counted for nothing. Women have often counted for very little. And the affairs of politicians have not considered their well-being at all. the value of every individual person is one of the principles of the Bible. And it's also one of those things where when a society recognizes the value of individuals, then it will not sacrifice individual just because others might want that to be so. In the Bible, Jesus says the good shepherd leaves a group of 99 sheep to find just one. And he's not just talking about sheep, of course. He's talking about people. One person. Every person matters. Jesus himself loved the poorest of the people, the most despised of the people, the outcasts. And Jesus says he takes personally the way we treat the least of these. He says, whatever you did to the least of these, you did to me. And so people who are influenced by Jesus say, everybody matters, even the very least in our society. And we need a system of government that at least tries to recognize that as much as we can. When Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, did he say, on the basis of secularism and atheism, we declare that all people have the same rights? No. He said, all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. He knew that it was from God that each person gets their value, and therefore each person has their rights from God, and that government's job is to recognize those rights, not to invent them. The rights exist because they've been endowed by their Creator with those rights of dignity and pursuit of happiness and of life and liberty. And God gives that, and government can only recognize those rights, not give those rights. When authority exists, it exists to serve. The greatest among you will be your servant, said Jesus. He washed his own disciples' feet, did the work of a slave, and then he said, if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you ought to wash one another's feet. So he found these guys who sometimes argued about who was the greatest, and he said, okay, I am the greatest. No doubt about that. You call me Lord and teacher, and you're right, I am. But I washed your feet, didn't I? Now what are you going to do with your authority? And this is true not just in the church, it's true in the political realm. If there are godly Christian people who hold positions of government, they're to be public servants who work for people's good. They're not to be proud tyrants who exploit people to enrich themselves. And what is the vision of government? What does government want to accomplish? Well, we can see what some of the pagan governments prized. You've got the pyramids. And people say, oh, what a great civilization ancient Egypt is. Well, yeah, if you were the pharaoh, but what if you were one of the thousands of slaves who had to build those things just so he had a fancy tomb? Maybe you wouldn't like it so much. The people of Israel certainly didn't enjoy slavery very much, and God set them free from it. But the pagans tend to prize the ability of their armies to conquer more and more territory and say, we're running that country too. And they tend to prize the grand building projects even when they're built by slave labor. But a truly great government defends people's right to flourish. A ruler's glory, real glory, is people who are flourishing. People who are flourishing under God. Micah 4 gives a picture of weapons becoming farm tools. Every man sits in the shade of his own tree without fear. He's free to serve God, free to love family, free to enjoy property and prosperity. And these are the things that government ought to do. Government can't create heaven on earth. It can do some things to prevent hell on earth by limiting what evildoers can accomplish, by trying to provide at least some structures of freedom. And once government gives freedom, hey, when you use that freedom wrongly and it is harmful to your life, you can't always count on the government to fix it for you. Freedom comes along with responsibility. And the biblical vision of it is that we have government under God, the rule of law, the separation of powers, the value of every person, the authority to serve, and a vision of people being free to flourish. This is the influence of Christianity historically in politics. And it hasn't produced perfect societies or perfect governments because there are no perfect people on earth yet. But it surely has improved governments and societies enormously wherever this influence has been widespread.